Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 37, we discuss the impact that the International Champions Cup and a $4 billion TV deal offer are having on Major League Soccer, as well as a new fantasy game from the Premier League, plus big news for fans of Scottish football. So my name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, fresh off the what can only be called a whirlwind of games on Wednesday night, but you were at the PSG-Juventus game.
Yeah, I was at the PSG-Juventus game in Miami, and it was an entertaining game, really good quality game. You can see why when you watch a game of this quality, even though it's a friendly, and I know I've talked about the sophistication of American audiences understanding that these games are meaningless, but when you see the quality on the pitch and just the quality of touches, the quality of shape and movement, and particularly from Juventus, even more. PSG has a lot of flair players, a lot of guys that are fun to watch, but just the quality of tactics from Max Allegri's side. You understand why so many people are willing to spend big bucks on this game. It was $40 for parking. It was tickets were very, very expensive in the hundreds of dollars. Why they're willing to spend money for these games and not go to domestic soccer, which I think is a little bit disappointing and sad, but it's something that is a reality that authorities in the game in this country have to accept and deal with. And I think we'll talk a little bit about that later.
Yeah, we will definitely get into this big time, because it is a huge topic, and it's a topic that a lot of people are not talking about. They're conveniently ignoring it, hoping it goes away. It's not going away. So we'll get into that in a bit. But first of all, congratulations to the U.S. team on the deserved, I think, CONCACAF Gold Cup championship there, beating Jamaica. Jamaica was... this was really tough, too, because there were so many games on last night. There was, like, what, four or three ICC games, and then there was the Gold Cup game. Then there's also Chivas against Santos in the Copa MX, and there was other games on, too. But I thought that the U.S. played extremely well. Jamaica put up a really good fight, and losing Andre Blake to that injury in about the 20th yeah. minute, that really set them back. But in terms of the television coverage, I didn't have any complaints, really. It was one of those things where... I tuned into the game, watched the game. At halftime, I went back to one of the ICC games, which would have been the, I think, the PSG-Juventus game. Once for about 15 minutes, went then back to the second half and watched the game.
Can I ask you a question, a very frank question about Fox? Sure. Because obviously I didn't watch the game. I was at this ICC game at the same time. Did they acknowledge this was a Jamaican B-side? It absolutely, if you look at the guys, Jamaica typically calls in, other than Andre Blake, the goalkeeper, and a couple of guys, the young Kamar Lawrence from Red Bulls, others, a few others, was a B-side. There were probably more regular stars for the United States playing last night than regular stars and guys who had an influence on the 2015 Gold Cup game when the U.S. lost to Jamaica, playing for the U.S. and playing for Jamaica. Was that it all discussed in Fox's coverage?
To be honest, I'm not sure, because I didn't tune in for the pre-match. I tuned in for maybe a few minutes just to see who was on the set.
I just wondered, because I think that there's this narrative that the U.S. is playing an experimental squad, a B squad. Now, of course, if Klinsmann were the manager, they would have savaged him for it, right? Oh, the results aren't good enough, or the performances aren't good enough. But there isn't the kind of and there's an acknowledgement Mexico came to the tournament with that as well. There isn't enough of a discussion of the fact that everybody in CONCACAF were playing largely experimental squads other than Canada. I just wonder about that, because the Costa Rica team the U.S. beat was not Costa Rica's full team. The guys that were really influential players on that team got recalled by their European clubs before that semifinal, when the change of the six players was made. The same thing can be said for the team that the U.S. played, the Panamanian team, in the first game of the tournament, not their full team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't mention that at all. It was, I mean, not surprisingly, again, a rah-rah kind of USA really kind of an experience from Fox there too. At the end of the final, at the final whistle, it sounded like as if the U.S. had won the World Cup, the way that John Strong, and especially for the winning goal, in terms of the call on that, I thought it was a little bit over the top. Yes, this is the Gold Cup, and yes, we all want to see the U.S. Do well and win these tournaments. But at the same time, Kartik, you know, I know, probably a lot of our listeners know too, that this was very much a B level, sometimes C level of competition in terms of the teams that these nations were fielding. So we have to keep that into context. But all in all, in terms of Fox's performance, at least, well, at the very, very end, at the final whistle, it goes, they go back to Rob Stone, and the first thing Rob Stone says, here we go. Like, this is now 14 unbeaten games for Bruce Arena in charge of this U.S. men's national team, which is all well and good. But when you play teams like Martinique, and you play teams like El Salvador and Nicaragua and a Costa Rica B team and a Jamaica B team and these other teams, you know, I mean, we're not playing the Argentina, Chile's, Brazil's, you know, Germany's of the world. So it's a good confidence boost. But again, too, I think from Rob Stone, it's very much rah-rah USA. And that feeds into the
again,
audience.
Again, if Klinsmann goes on a similar run, there isn't that conversation, right? It's not. It's basically all the flaws. Why did we struggle against Martinique? Why did we struggle against El Salvador? How could we struggle against a Jamaican B team? It would probably be pointed out if Klinsmann were the manager that it was a Jamaican B team. And I am not a fan of Klinsmann. People who follow me on Twitter know that I felt like he was a substandard manager, horrible tactically, and a wrong fit for this program. But here's just a reflection on the conversation I had last night with another journalist about this very topic, Chris. Basically, this person told me, look, at some point, all of us who are concerned and about Fox's coverage and complain about Fox's coverage, just disengage. Watch the Premier League. Watch U.S. games on Univision. Watch U.S. games on Telemundo. There are U.S. fans. They feel like they have to gin up patriotism and overplay how good the team is to the audience. So maybe you just accept that, and if you want to consume the games, go consume them somewhere else or some other way. And maybe that's the point some of us are at.
Well, that's the big question, because Univision had this game on too, so it'll be interesting to see what the TV numbers are for this one. I mean, you had USA against Jamaica, so it's a very English speaking audience. So how does Univision do in the TV ratings compared to FS1? FS1 should be a slam dunk with an English-speaking audience and with the United States in the final. But it'll be interesting to see what Univision does with those numbers and how close they get. But it's interesting, too, Kartik, because I didn't catch this, so I watched the Fox broadcast. Oliver Say, who occasionally writes for World Soccer Talk, sent me an email, and he was explaining how it was Santos against Chivas, which is the Copa MX, a game that was on right before the Gold Cup final on Univision. And in this one, the reason that the time kickoff time had been pushed back to 9:50 Eastern time was because of the Copa MX game. They wanted to have that game over and done with on Univision and then go over to the U.S. Jamaica final. I'm sure they were hoping it was U.S.-Mexico final, but that's another story. So he said that Univision ran commercials after the Santos-Chivas Copa MX match ended late, and that was past 9:50 Eastern time. By the time Univision finished running commercials, the Gold Cup match had already started. What did Univision do? Univision tried to cover it up. What it did was, one, it showed the kickoff of the Gold Cup final on tape delay. So the kickoff was on tape delay. And then they had a quick cutaway shot of Bruce Arena that allowed Univision then to skip the first 4 minutes of the match to get up to live action. And then they didn't display the clock on the score graphic until 5 minutes into the match. So to kind of catch people by surprise and then hope that they didn't notice that the game actually had already kicked off and then try to catch up magically. Thank God for Univision that nobody scored in the first 5 minutes. That would have been completely embarrassing. But interesting tactics there from Univision. And it's tough. It's one of those situations, like, what do you do when that happens?
They may not have done it if someone had scored, let's say, in the second minute, because by that time they know, and then they probably do it. They don't put the score bug at the top. They probably do it like between minutes 10 and 14. But it's I empathize with them, actually. I'm not sure what you do in that situation.
Yeah. And it's live television, so it's difficult. So you have to make that call right. I'm sure they saw that as the game was going on with the Copa MX game, that it was going to run over into the U.S. game. But, yeah, that's difficult. That's a high-pressure stakes in television. God bless them. All right, Kartik, so in terms of what we've been watching this past week, other than the Gold Cup final, for me personally, I've been watching a ton of International Champions Cup games. And I must say that this year's edition, I think, has been the most competitive I've ever seen, competitive on the pitch. And in terms of the not just the starting lineups for these teams, I've been really surprised by how many A players are starting these games, but also just the level of competition in terms of how competitive it is for going in for tackles and end-to-end action. And there's been a bunch of games this week that we've seen that with. The Spurs against Roma game ended up being a 3-2 win for Roma in the last minute. That was a really entertaining match to watch. And then you had the PSG-Juventus game, Kartik. You were there in person, but I watched it on television. On television, it felt, and the atmosphere was great. Inside the new refurbished Joe Robbie Stadium, Hard Rock Stadium, it looked incredible on television. But for me, that felt like not quite a UEFA Champions League final, but it could have easily been if PSG had found their way into the final. PSG had a few players that started that usually wouldn't start a game, but the Juventus team was stacked, and so too was the PSG team too, except for a couple of exceptions. But overall, I've been really pleasantly surprised about how competitive ICC has been, and if anything, it's been more competitive and more entertaining and watchable than the Gold Cup.
Oh, it's certainly been more entertaining than the Gold Cup, or watchable than the Gold Cup. CONCACAF. Look, the thing about the Gold Cup every two years, I think I talked about this last week or the week before, is that you have theatrics, you have play acting, you have the kinds of things that either get you very angry or motivate you to watch because something outrageous is going to happen. That's the tournament, even when it's an A tournament. And by the way, this year, we're not the only ones saying that the tournament has been remarkably bad from a football perspective. But I think you've seen a combination of teams playing very competitively and very aggressively. This is going to be a long year. This is a World Cup year. So basically, the guys you're seeing play football right now for these big clubs, a lot of them are going to be playing all the way through mid-July of next year and then get a 2 or 3 week break. And I don't know with Qatar in 2022 how schedules are going to be configured, but you might start seeing European seasons shifted. Maybe it'd be the following year to start playing into that 2022 World Cup. So it's going to be a busy year, and I think guys are probably fitter, hungrier, and sharper this preseason because they know the stakes, how good the stakes, how big the stakes are. I think we saw this in the ICC in 2013, actually, Chris, the very first ICC. Mm-hmm. And then the play dropped off in 14, which is right after a World Cup. I don't think the games were particularly good in 15 or 16 either. But you're right, they have been good this year. Most teams playing their starters. Last night, PSG didn't have Julian Draxler. He's still coming back from the Confed Cup, where he led Germany to the title. And Kevin Trapp, who had been suspended. He had been sent off in the previous game in Orlando. But it was basically a full team. Some managers are treating it differently, though. We have to talk about the Man United Man City game last week, where out of the blue, Pep Guardiola started Phil Foden, 17-year-old academy player from Stockport.
He was incredible.
And gave him about 80 minutes.
Yeah.
And he was fantastic.
He was brilliant. And I was like, it's just a breath of fresh air. Just seeing him on the pitch and seeing what he was doing.
Right. And this is just a week or two after he had led, or a couple of weeks after he had led England in the U17s, Euro U17s. So he's a very, very polished young local player, which is what we want to see at Manchester City. A little bit of a to-do between Pep and Gary Neville. Neville saying, well, he's at the wrong Manchester club as a local guy to develop. And, you know, recent evidence might suggest that, although in the period between the emergence of, let's say, Danny Welbeck and the class of 92, that 20-year period or 15-year period, Man City was producing better local players coming through their system. So, you know, this thing is cyclical. But that game was good. I want to point out that game for a specific reason, which is this is preseason, and we know the ICC isn't necessarily staffed or handled with – there are roster registration rules, et cetera, for the tournament, but it's not – quite, and the public information isn't quite like a regular league. It's not like covering Major League Soccer or the Premier League or the Bundesliga, a game in one of those leagues where you can find the registered players. There's certain procedures. So Derek Ray and Craig Burley were on the call for ESPN. They did a fantastic job. And this just shows you the kind of pro Derek Ray is and how some other commentators might have had a more difficult time with it. They had guys playing in that game that weren't on the squad sheet that were given to the two commentators. They had guys that were high number players that were not on the squad sheet. They had guys like Gabriel Jesus, who is a big superstar, right? Mm-hmm. From Man City, who was not on the squad sheet. The bottom line is that they were able to work through it and able to identify, this guy's on the pitch, that guy's on the pitch. Let's find out who this is. Jesus, they knew who he was, but he hadn't been on their squad sheet. So, and again, I think Ray and Burley were remote, right? They weren't at the venue. So that might have complicated it. But it just, to me, once again, point out what a pro Derek Ray is, one of the best in the business. Craig Burley right up there with him. And a reminder for people who are newer or don't remember, per se, to the sport, those two paired a lot on games when Craig Burley was still based in the UK. And they've paired a fair amount on games during the summer since Burley moved to the US. So it's an all-Scottish team. I know the accents might annoy some people who listen, but I love having those two guys call games. And I love having Derek Ray team with Stuart Robson. That's been one of the great thrills of the ICC for me, is that you're getting Ray, Burley, Robson, a lot more of Twellman, which I love, and all of the ESPN commentators in the booth. Just finishing up on what I watched this week also, besides
Hang on, Kartik. So the Manchester Derby, though, I mean, to me, it was a really entertaining game, and it was especially the first half. And I thought that this was a lot more entertaining than an average Manchester Derby in the Premier League, because, you know, I mean, Jose and his kind of very kind of going for a 0-0 draws type of thing has made some of those derbies a little bit, boring. But this one was really breathtaking to watch and just a really pleasant game. Second half kind of dragged a bit, but the first half was really top stuff. And then Kartik, I would also echo in terms of I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as far as ESPN's coverage, have been really pleasantly, well, actually not even surprised at all, but pleasantly amused by the actual commentary. For example, the Real Madrid Manchester United game, there was some really lovely dry English humor from John Champion in this match with Craig Burley. So there's some back and forth. And at one point in the game, too, John Champion was talking about having drinks in a bar the night before with fans of the U.S. men's national team, and just the banter back and forth between John Champion and Craig Burley kind of trying to talk through that as far as what they got up to. That was interesting, and it didn't divert from the match itself. It was during a lull in the game. I would say, though, too, the Barcelona-Man United match on Wednesday night, I'm not sure if there were audio difficulties, or if it was that anyway, the John Champion Craig Burley, the audio wasn't the greatest. It sounded muffled at times. I'm not sure if it was the crowd noise or what it was, but it was hard to understand Craig Burley at times, and I'm not sure again too if that was the noise level or if he was talking too fast or if he was mumbling a bit. But that was in direct contrast to Derek Ray and Stuart Robson that did the PSG Juventus game. And both of those came through loud and clear. And it was easy to hear them and easy to understand. But overall, so far, I've been really impressed by ESPN's coverage. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, so thank you for that, Chris. I want to address ESPN FC as an anchor program, as kind of a key bumper program when ESPN is actually showing games or has a tournament that they're showing at the club level. So what we've had the last 4 years is ESPN FC as a program that covers, that analyzes, breaks down club football matches, obviously international matches also, and they have a lot of international football still, even though they've lost FIFA rights. But club matches that they don't have, that they don't cover as a network, right? And they're analyzing games that are shown on VN or Fox or NBC or whatever other channel in the United States. What has been so interesting in this tournament, and they didn't do this in the previous editions of the ICC, which they broadcast. I guess it was just last year was the first one they broadcast.
Correct.
But that they have kind of utilized ESPN FC as a studio anchor program for this tournament. And I think, again, we talked about the tournament being underwhelming last year, and I don't know that there was quite the push last season, last summer, to get this tournament in everyone's faces, other than obviously the game at the Big House and a couple of other examples of that. But remember, ESPN was also just coming off the Euros when this happened last year, so I don't think they had quite the commitment level to broadcast it. What we're seeing is that they're taking advantage of the ICC. Dan Thomas, Shaka Hislop, Gab Marcotti came to Orlando for a couple of days to spend some time with Spurs. They got a 15-minute interview with Mauricio Pochettino. Who gets that? 10 or 15 minutes, mm-hmm. Talking about every aspect of the club, breaking down players, Vertonghen, Lloris on the set, Harry Kane on the set. Right there with them at Disney in Orlando, which, of course, Disney is ESPN's parent company, so that was an easy arrangement, I'm sure, yeah, for them to make. But still, that's sometimes why synergies, companies, conglomerates work for this sort of thing, media companies. So that was really good. And then this week, they've had Stuart Robson in studio all week, which to me is a treat, and he is so well prepared and so well studied on all of the teams in this competition and the transfer situation. And they've been able to use the fact that they have this tournament, that they're showing PSG games, they're showing Juve games, they're showing Real Madrid and Barcelona games, they're showing Spurs games, Man City games, whoever else, Dortmund, Arsenal, Chelsea, to their advantage, to actually have points of reference on that program that they don't necessarily have, and their entire team is stateside, mm-hmm, for a change. So Marcotti is here, Robson is here, Derek Ray is here, and it's been really good to see how they've worked this into the show. And it's not that they've ignored other football going on. They've been able to bring on Herc Gomez to talk a little bit about Liga MX kicking off, mm-hmm, and Copa MX. They've been able to bring Alejandro Moreno and Seb Salah are in to talk a little bit about MLS. Actually, Seb Salazar can talk European football too. So it's been a really good week for ESPN FC. I know a lot of our listeners don't watch the program, although you'd be surprised. There are a lot of soccer fans here locally in South Florida that I talk to, and they watch the program religiously, and they talk to me about Craig Burley regularly. People who come even to our Boca FC games about, oh, did you see the outrageous thing Burley said the other day? Or generally, they don't think it's outrageous. They like Burley, and they think that the other guys are too Americanized. But that's, yeah, the opinion of people who are European soccer fans who come to our Boca FC games. But it has been a really interesting week for that program. And it's a program I'm kind of a religious devotee of, so maybe I'm overly enthusiastic. But I've been – it's been must-see TV for me this week because they've got games buffering their actual program.
I think, Kartik, this could be a massive point for ESPN in terms of soccer coverage. And I mean International Champions Cup in general, in terms of the level of competition at this year's summer tournament, the stellar teams that we have playing, and the entertainment value. And actually, Kartik and I are going to be joining ESPN this weekend for some interviews and meetings, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot from that and be able to share that back with you next week and in coming weeks, as well as on the website. But I'm interested in knowing, in terms of more details about the contract, I mean, how many more years is this for? And this really could put ESPN back on the club soccer map. I'm talking about international club soccer map, because, yes, we know they have the Euros and we know that they have Major League Soccer. But outside of that, other than the occasional World Cup qualifier every few months or an occasional
European Nations Cup they're going to have.
Yeah, but still, so other than those national games, as far as club soccer, as far as international club soccer, this could be their ticket to ride every summer, having just some of the best teams from around the world on ESPN, on the main ESPN, with some great anchor coverage. I really think that this could be – I mean, this has already been pretty big for ESPN this summer, but this could even get bigger and bigger depending on how long that contract is for.
Yeah, and let's think about this, Chris. This is an opportunity for them to engage their personnel. They have a lot of soccer personnel that don't get to do a whole lot of matches, sit in a studio most of the time, Craig Burley, Stevie Nicol, et cetera, Shaka, that sit in a studio and they end up doing things for ESPN International, but they don't do a whole lot necessarily club calls for ESPN. This is very different than the days of the inception of ESPN3, or it was ESPN 360 at the time, when they used to have the online rights for La Liga at times and Serie A and the Portuguese league, and you would hear Tommy Smith at the time. It was Tommy Smith and Robbie Musto, which is with NBC now. You'd hear their voice 6-7 times a week. It seemed. Now they don't have any of those games. Seeing the success of how they've been able to use their personnel and all of the people who are on air personalities with ESPN, and actually Max Brados, who's a soccer guy, is from South Florida, is going to have a bit of a homecoming this week. We'll talk more about that, I'm sure, next week. Being able to come back and do some soccer coverage this week with El Clasico in Miami. Mm-hmm. How they've been able to use all this personnel in the last 2 weeks is impressive to me. And maybe it is the trigger for ESPN as they are downsizing their departments, right? As they're letting personnel go, as they're retreating from a lot of the excess or overspending that they've done on sports rights and sports properties in the last decade. This is obviously well chronicled as people cut the cord, et cetera. Maybe they see the value in how they can use their personnel and they go for what might be a cheap club football property. Maybe they do go out and try and get the Football League rights and get the League Cup with it. Right. Maybe they do go out and spend a little more time and emphasis on the fact that they do have the rights to the Copa del Rey. They do have the rights to the German Cup. I don't know how long those rights run for, or necessarily the arrangements around them. And maybe they build a little more around those cup competitions. It'll be interesting to see, because I think this has been potentially, and you and I will ask these questions in the next few days, a dry run for an audition for greater club football coverage. It's unfortunate because ESPN put all this infrastructure in place and the studio team in place after they had lost the rights to just about everything they had.
So two things there. One is I think that they're still going to focus on more of the kind of the big tournaments. So whether it's International Champions Cup or Nations League or Euro 2020 and those big type of events, and then use and they've been better using their talent and production around those types of events, and less so. My intelligence in terms of some of my sources in terms of the Championship, FA Cup, and several other properties that ESPN has had an opportunity to bid on. I think almost all of those they've passed on. So I don't think they're interested in those types of more kind of the, more of an English type of competitions, but they seem to be more in terms of more of a world. International Champions Cup, yes, you have teams from Europe, but it has a very global appeal to it. If you're a fan of French soccer, Spanish soccer, especially with the Hispanic audience, I think that's what they seem to be kind of catering more towards. And then the European competitions, people from around the world can really enjoy those types of high level, no matter whether you're Hispanic or Anglo or whatever it is. The second thing is that, and I'm not sure if you caught this, Kartik, but I've been really impressed by how ESPN, and we saw this too, actually, I think it was pre-match on the Spurs-Roma game, how ESPN's Marty Smith went on the road with Cristiano Ronaldo through China, and he followed him along the way, did a ton of sit-down interviews, one-on-ones, and tried to get inside Cristiano Ronaldo's head as far as kind of what type of person he is and what he's thinking and what his goals are and those types of questions, as well as learning more about him as an individual. And I thought that series was well done. And they've had different spots now and again where they have some additional video as well as some additional interviews that they've shared. And that was on SportsCenter. So they're really trying to, I think, go more mainstream in some ways in terms of appeal to soccer fans. But I've been really impressed by what I've seen. And like I said to you, like you said to Kartik, I'm sure we'll be finding out a lot more this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the thing we've talked about over and over again on this show and on this network, is that there is a clear difference in the way ESPN presents the sport to the way Fox does. And I think, again, that contrast has been vivid the last few weeks as ICC's been ongoing and the Gold Cup has been on Fox. But again, we saw Fox can raise their game as they did for the Confed Cup. So the question is, do they, in spite of some of the rhetoric coming out of their mouths, do they learn from the types of things ESPN does. I mean, that is the type of piece you'd like to see on Fox in World Cup coverage, assuming Portugal's there next year. They learn these sort of things around the game that they need to do, not just match coverage that ESPN does so well at?
I think they have, and I think they will, which will surprise some people. But, I mean, to me, there's two different huge differences. So Fox Sports under David Neal as the executive producer who did the Confederations Cup, he did the Women's World Cup, and he's going to be doing the World Cup. So in terms of the level of detail, I'm sure the budget, the amount of talent, the amount of help that's available, and the attention to detail there, to me, it's going to be a world-class event. And yes, Fox will make mistakes, but they'll do some things to surprise us too, and I think they'll do well. The other side of Fox, which is what we see Gold Cup and Champions League and day-to-day, where for the most part we either ignore it or have grown old with it, or grown tired with it, is the Jaunty Whitehead, who's a producer at Fox Sports and kind of dumbs down the coverage for the American audience, and that's what we see in there. So there's actually two sides to Fox, and so for the big events, I think we'll be okay. For the day-to-day normal stuff, it's just par for the course. They just kind of go through the motions, although they have improved that as far as the production side. The talent side still has got work to do. I will mention one more thing, Kartik, before we move on to the next segment, and this is, I was really disappointed with this, and I forgot to mention it earlier, was that the USA Costa Rica semifinal. So there was a high point and a low point. The high point for me was seeing the shot of the gantry, for lack of a better word, with John Strong, Landon Donovan, and Stu Holden, and that was the moment of celebration on camera from the booth, when Dempsey scored the goal to equal Landon Donovan's record. And you could see just the emotions among all three of them, but also Landon Donovan celebrating the fact that Dempsey had just tied that goal-scoring record. I thought that was a great shot and a great moment in the match coverage. The second thing, though, too, Kartik, and this is the low point, and I was so disappointed with this, was Eric Winalda was on the set. And I was like, wow, Winalda's been given an opportunity, a golden opportunity to shine here, but he failed to take it. And I was so disappointed, because at halftime, he was asked for his analysis, and he said roughly these words. He said, I'm just going to echo what Landon Donovan just said, and I think that they will play with a 4-3-3 in the second half. And that was it. So while that analysis was good, all it did was added more credence to Landon Donovan, and it didn't provide any valuable insight from Winalda on his own terms. It was just kind of echoing what somebody else had said. The challenge that he has when he's on the set is when Rob Stone kind of turns to somebody for match analysis or kind of tactical analysis, the first person he goes to is Ali Wagner. I mean, Ali Wagner goes into and says, okay, well, they should have been playing out wide or whatever she says. And then they go to Winalda. So he's in a tough position where he has to come up with something original and has, like, what, 15 seconds to come up with something?
Right. I was going to say, I think it's the time constraint. And he's just not being utilized properly at that network. We don't have to have a whole show about it.
But he could do better than that, though. I mean, and I was just really disappointed. And I don't know if they told him, okay, you're on the show, but you have to kind of play it cool. Don't be too negative. And maybe,
yeah, I'm sure they did.
I was really disappointed, because I was really hoping that he would, deliver a good zinger as far as, some good analysis that we know he's capable of doing. But all he did just said, yeah, like whatever Landon said, I agree with. And I thought, like, okay, come on, you can do better than that.
Look, I think there's been a campaign against Eric Winalda. Maybe that's a strong word. That's a Jose Mourinho word, right? A campaign against Chelsea. But there's been a systematic attempt by bloggers, by people on Twitter, people who are very supportive of Major League Soccer and U.S. soccer and the system and all of that, to marginalize his voice and marginalize his opinion. So don't think he's not conscious of that every time he goes on the air at that network. And the U.S. is a topic of discussion. Now, you see in his element, when that's removed, the shackles removed, he's with Kate Abdo and with who's heating out in Russia, talking about things that don't involve the United States, how good he can be.
Yeah, or on his radio show on Sirius XM.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, but still, I was just kind of thinking that he would provide some analysis of his own rather than just saying, okay, yeah, I agree with what Donovan said. But it is what it is. So coming up in a little bit, we've got some big news from the world of soccer, including some massive news for fans of Scottish football and much more. But before we go to the break, I do want to mention our sponsor, and that's SeatGeek. Buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. And with SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. Now, coming up this weekend, we've got El Clasico, but there's still plenty of International Champions Cup friendlies, as well as other friendlies from around the world being played, and concerts and theater, etc. So you can use the SeatGeek app, which I have on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and just with a few taps, I can instantly find seats. Now, SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. That's promo code WSTPOD for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now, Kartik, on to you for the TV streaming news.
Yeah, a pretty busy week. First off, the NASL has renewed their deal with BN Sports and BN Sports Espanol for the fall season. Some of you who might follow me on Twitter and on Reddit realize that I think this is quite significant for the league, not because they're renewing this deal. They've had the deal in place. The big component this time is that they've announced the games that are going to be in BN Sports and Espanol well in advance. We were finding out, and I was working with an NASL team last year, so I know this firsthand. We were finding out week of or 10 days in advance which games were going to be on regular BN and which games were going to be on BN in Espanol. So that's the big thing. And now is that you have a lot of lead time to promote these games and the proper partner networks. Mm-hmm. So that's critical for the NASL, because I think what we found last year was that people who were fans of NASL were going to be in the English language BN, and the game was on Espanol, or vice versa. Now that this is being properly promoted, I think they can create maybe even a separate audience for both properties. And it's very important that the league get itself better ensconced in the Spanish language audience in this country. They have not done a good job of that over the course of 7 years now.
In other news, NBC Sports app has now has authentication with Fubo TV. So if you're a Fubo TV subscriber, you can go ahead and log into the NBC Sports app and use your Fubo username and login to go ahead and password to actually go and access that. So the great thing about it is that whether it's on NBC Sports apps, which are on Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire, or smartphones, computers, etc., you don't have to be a cable subscriber to get the NBC Sports app anymore. You can just get Fubo and then authenticate through using your Fubo login. Kartik, what's next?
ESPN has added a ton of friendlies in the next few weeks that will be shown live on ESPN3. We have the full fixture list on the Premier League schedule page on worldsoccertalk.com. Go to worldsoccertalk.com to find that. They include Werder Bremen versus West Ham United. Obviously, West Ham has been very busy this summer. Wolves and Leicester, Arsenal Benfica, Man United versus Sampdoria, Crystal Palace versus Schalke, Red Bull Leipzig, RB Leipzig, excuse me, versus Stoke, Everton versus Sevilla, Brighton versus Atleti, and many others.
And in other news, the Premier League has launched a brand new game entitled Fantasy Premier League Draft, which is its own very own draft league from different... which is quite different than actually the traditional fantasy league game. So any, for any of you who have played draft leagues before for NFL or for college football, etc., you can now do it with the official Fantasy Premier League Draft. Both of the fantasy games are free, and they're both separate. And if you're interested in playing the game, you can head on over to worldsoccertalk.com on the homepage there to find out how you can play against me and other World Soccer Talk listeners from around the world. So check it out.
La Liga has announced the schedule for the 17-18 season. Opening weekend will include Barcelona, Real Betis, Deportivo, Real Madrid, Sevilla, Espanyol, and Girona, and Atleti. Chris, have you noticed when the Super Clásico, the El Clásico fixtures are? It's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, so it's Saturday, August. Off the top of my head, it's, I think it's August.
Oh no, but that's the Supercopa, the actual La Liga fixtures.
I know that.
Okay,
there.
So the first match is in December. It is the last game before the Christmas break. Okay. That's pretty remarkable. So it's the last fixture in the first half of the season, and then the second fixture is the week of the Champions League semifinals. You wonder if La Liga might have done a better job of protecting their two giants by having those games at maybe a different time. Maybe it's a nice way to lead it to the winter break, but boy, that game in May, that's that timing could be very awkward for both clubs, assuming they're both still alive in Champions League.
Yeah, interesting. I'll have to look at the calendar, because like oftentimes whenever there's the international break and then they have El Clasico, which has happened before, it doesn't do as well because, you mean, it's kind of that lull where everyone kind of, yeah. So hopefully it fits in where it's kind of during a hectic schedule and then you have that game to kind of be the cherry on top. But interesting. And then finally, in news, some big news for Scottish fans of the Scottish Premiership in the US is that there is currently no TV deal in place. So previously, in previous years, we had Fox Sports that showed some of the games on Fox Soccer Plus, as well as the Old Firm derbies, usually at on FS1 or FS2, as well as Fox Soccer To Go, which had an average of about three Scottish Premiership matches a weekend. As of right this second, there's no TV deal in place, and Fox Sports is not continuing with the Scottish Premiership. So what happens is, if you do want to watch your Celtic or Rangers or Aberdeen, etc., is that most of the Scottish Premiership sites now have streaming packages, so you can go directly to Celtic TV or Rangers TV, etc., and subscribe to a streaming package, which is for the entire season. So Rangers TV, as one example, is $300 for the entire year, which gives you home and away games, as well as behind-the-scenes coverage, interviews, etc. The Celtic one is, I think, $200 a year. And then for the other teams, it's different pricing, too. So it's this could be, and this is a massive change. It's one of those things that it's the clubs going directly to you, rather than, say, you going to Fox and watching the games there. So if you're a fan of certain clubs in the Scottish Premiership, it's actually, in some ways, could be a good thing in that you'll be able to see all the games home and away, rather than just relying on Fox in the past, where you might have seen one or two here or there. But still, at the end of the day, it's not good news, I think, for the Scottish Premiership as a whole, especially in the United States, in terms of exposure, because now you're limiting it to streaming, and that goes to the hardcore of the hardcore fans, and doesn't help introduce that league to others that might fall in love with the Old Firm derby or the history or tradition and all the things that go around Scottish football. Any thoughts on that one, Kartik, or...
Yeah, that's really a tough one for Scottish football, I think, as a whole. It may be better for specific fans of clubs that can see every game in this manner now. But as far as the league growing its presence in the U.S., I think that ship has sailed. And it's something that I find a little odd, because there are so many – I don't encounter that many Rangers fans in my daily or weekly soccer activities, but I encounter – so many Celtic fans. I mean, I want to say I encounter as many Celtic fans, hardcore Celtic fans, as I do fans of most English Premier League clubs. And yet there's really no way to follow that league in this country without paying over an arm and a leg. Mm-hmm.
And just as one example, too, the last Old Firm derby that was in the Scottish Premiership, which was back in March, that one was on FS1, I think on a Sunday morning or Saturday morning. Fox didn't promote it at all, so most people wouldn't have known it was on, but that one had a viewership of 73,000. So not a huge number, not a tiny number, but still, you would think,
well,
too.
It's more than they get for a lot of Bundesliga games, which they do promote.
That's true, Kartik, with all the promotion that they put into the Bundesliga. That's a good point there. But it is one of those things that, you mean, if you don't promote it, people don't know it's there. It's hard to get some big numbers, which has been the longest thing with Fox for forever, is promote what you got. It's not that complicated. But, okay. Well, speaking of TV ratings, let's move on to that. And some big numbers coming out this past week. We had 3.8 million people that watched the Mexico-Jamaica match. That one was the semi-final where Jamaica had won the match, surprisingly. On Univision and Univision Deportes for that game, it was 3 million. And then FS1 had almost 800,000 people for that one. The USA-Costa Rica semifinal, that one had 2.1 million. And it was 1.1 million on Unimas and Galavision. And then 1 million on FS1. So the Unimas and Galavision beat the number for FS1. It was on Unimas and Galavision because I think at that night there was also Liga MX back on for the new season. And then so as far as some of the other numbers to throw out there too, we had for the Manchester Derby on ESPN, that was 452,000. Pretty decent number for a late game on the on that network. The Real Madrid against Man United on ESPN had 443,000 people. Juventus against Barcelona on ESPN, 403,000. And then we kind of get into some of the smaller numbers for the other games. Anything else out there, Kartik, that jumps out at you, some of the numbers?
Yeah, the NWSL number was down again this week. It was down for the first time in a while this week, 81,000 for Pride Red Stars. I should have mentioned this in my summary of games I watched. It was that was one game I did watch start to finish. Christian Press, for me right now, maybe the best American footballer, male or female.
Wow. And in terms of MLS, some numbers there, 338,000 for Orlando Atlanta on ESPN. And then we had Minnesota against New York Red Bulls was 222,000. And last but not least, 155,000 for Vancouver against Portland on FS1 and Fox Deportes combined. And that was part of a doubleheader that they had. So they had that match, and that was followed then by the Mexico-Jamaica game. So moving on to listener mailbag, and we've got one comment here from someone we know pretty closely, Kartik. This is Robin Burt, who used to be on this podcast, and he sent this in through Facebook, and this is on the topic of last week when we were talking about friendlies and whether they're meaningful or not. And he says, the friendlies are 100% meaningless. I took my son to Seattle last July to see our beloved West Ham play the Sounders. It was such a slow and ponderous game. Thankfully, the Sounders kind of cared. Otherwise, I would have had to say that I would not waste my money on buying another friendly ticket again. We flew from Los Angeles to Seattle, spent two nights in the hotel, and then were served up with a load of dreck on the pitch. It's not for me. I can barely watch friendlies on TV.
Yeah, our former co-host Robin Bird, I tend to agree with him to a large extent. That's why Manchester City comes to the country every year, and I never fly out to see them. I went to see them, I think I mentioned last week or previous week on this podcast, in 2010. Went to see them in 2013, have not gone since, even though they come every year. And by all means, I would normally go, but that's the kind of level you've seen. But this ICC is beginning to change my mind about it, this year's ICC specifically, because I think there's a greater intensity. The question is it because we're going playing into a World Cup year and next year we're going to see a drop off again in the level of friendlies, or is it something that might be semi-permanent? And we don't have the answer for that right now, but I tend to relate to Robin's sentiments on this.
Yeah, I disagree with Robin in that I understand where he's coming from, but I think it's not the friendlies' fault. but it's, in this case, it's West Ham United's fault. So I think they think West Ham United doesn't know how to market their team overseas. So if I was West Ham United, I would put out a strong team and have them play at a competitive level against the Seattle team, because it's an opportunity to go ahead and win new fans, sell merchandise, and adopt fans. And I go back to one of my examples, which is I took my daughter to a Chelsea practice, I think before the game against AC Milan a few years ago in Miami. And we were just at the practice the night before the game, and she got to see, you know, John Terry and Lukaku and a whole bunch of the stars, Frank Lampard. And she was hooked. And ever since that day, she's been a Chelsea fan, much to my chagrin. But it's one of those things that it does, if you do it the right way, I think it's an opportunity to make it work. But if for West Ham United, if you go in with the thinking, okay, we just turn up, and then all of a sudden we make a ton of money, and then we move on, that's a recipe for disaster. And it makes West Ham look bad. It makes these friendlies look bad.
Yeah, I remember that about your daughter. We went to see Everton train a couple of years ago here in Miami, and you brought your daughter, and I was trying to convince her to be an Everton fan, and she was already hooked on Chelsea. So
I know.
It's funny. I'm a Man City supporter, but people who know me and have adopted English football clubs know that I always push Everton on them for whatever reason.
Right.
So
Kartik,
I've been accused of being a closet Everton fan. Maybe I am.
But Kartik, so Man City, though, you became a Man City fan through a friendly, though, right?
Correct.
So it just goes to show. Yeah, it just goes to show the impact that these friendlies can have. It can hook someone for life and say, okay, all right. And sometimes it can be, you know, so I think it's definitely on the team's part to put the best effort forward. And I think West Ham in this case did not. If you guys do have any questions or feedback or comments, be sure to send those in to us, and we'll be glad to read them out on air, as we did with Robin's comment. And you can reach us through email at web@worldsoccertalk.com. Twitter is WSoccerTalk, and then Facebook is facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. So let's move on to our featured topic of the week, Kartik, and I'll start this one off, and feel free to chime in. But my personal thinking is that in terms of what I've seen just in this past week, and this goes back for years, but this week especially so, is that MLS is under attack from International Champions Cup and also this MP and Silver TV deal. My perspective is that how can MLS compete against ICC when ICC is coming over here every summer, they're getting better TV ratings, they're getting better attendances, and they're generating all of the publicity and attention and winning new fans. And in the same week, you got revelations came out that MP and Silver offered Major League Soccer $4 billion to restructure the U.S. soccer pyramid by adding promotion relegation between the different leagues. So these two things together, ICC and then the MP and Silver deal, it's a bad look for MLS. The league is seen as being on the outside. It seems to be kind of backward thinking, and it's stuck in a generation where it's all about trying to generate as much money for the NFL owners of these MLS clubs instead of trying to grow the game in the U.S. And after watching these International Champions Cup games and then watching MLS, MLS looks bad on television, and it feels inferior, and that just perpetuates the problem for Major League Soccer when the new European season starts in a few weeks, and then you have all of these teams that have come over for the ICC, and now you can see many of them on television, you mean close up, week in, week out, as well as other clubs. And to me, at the end of the day, Kartik, the European clubs are in control of the U.S. soccer market for every single month of the year. So you go from August all the way through to May. In June, you usually have the Champions League and the Europa League. Then in July, they're here. They're dominating this market. And I think that Major League Soccer can't compete. And at the same time, not only can they compete, but I think it's one of those things from the television perspective is that they're in a losing battle where they seem to be stuck to their principles. They're not willing to change. Not willing to adopt, whether it's the MP and Silver deal or other changes that could benefit the league in the United States. And at the end of the day, it's all about where the stars are. And the stars are in whether it's European leagues, Liga MX leagues, South American leagues. But it's an equal playing field. And I think for the most part, that's why we're seeing some record numbers, people spending, I mean, hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to watch these matches in person. And then for the rest of the year, they're watching it on television. And Major League Soccer, to me, is the big loser here.
Okay, let's separate these two issues. They're two very different issues. Because leagues in China, Australia, India, Malaysia, Thailand, you name it, if there's an English language speaking component in those countries, African countries, they all have the same issues as MLS with things like the ICC, things like European football. It's not something that's going to get solved. It's happening. It's ripping the soul out of the domestic game around the planet in many places. So I don't think there's much MLS can do about that other than the fact that there's more money here. There are guys like Stephen Ross who are bringing high-level games here. That's one issue, and that's a difficult one for MLS. What should not be a difficult one for MLS, but they put themselves in a box, is the other component, which is MP and Silva. It doesn't have to be MP and Silva. It can be anyone. But the whole conversation of promotion and relegation. For whatever reason, they're really obstinate to having an open pyramid, an open league in this country. And I think it's important we acknowledge, because so many people who are on the pro-rel side of this argument don't. We have to acknowledge the strides the sport in this country has made thanks to Major League Soccer. The resources that have been poured into player development and stadiums and just maintenance of a high-level first division where players, American players and players from other CONCACAF countries, you see that with Jamaica's success in the last two Gold Cups, the core of their team have been MLS-based in 15 and 17 and got to the finals in both tournaments, beating U.S. and Mexico to get there in the respective tournaments, are MLS-based. So the league has done some great things. But if you don't have an open system, if you don't have promotion and relegation, eventually investment dries up in the league. Now, you can say all this, you can sell franchises for $150 million. That will eventually come to an end. Okay? You're eventually going to hit a law of diminishing returns with that. And there is so much interest in grassroots soccer in this country. The whole issue of the ICC and European football and the ratings, that's a completely separate issue. There is enough energy and interest in grassroots soccer in this country, youth soccer. People who are committed to their youth soccer programs, but their programs have been frozen out of the U.S. Soccer Development Academy, and they're unable to compete for players at the U15 and U17 levels because of these U.S. Soccer Development Academies, NPSL and PDL clubs that are not able to advance up the pyramid. They have ambitious owners. They have people like Roberto Saca down the road here in Miami with Miami United, who have invested a lot of money, a lot of effort, brought Adriano to this country, but they're blocked in the fourth division level. Then you talk about second and third division. You could go on and on. There is a lot of investment, a lot of interest, and a lot of potential investment in lower division soccer in this country, which would grow the entire sport, grow the American player, grow the footprint of this sport in this country, where I firmly believe it would be competitive, the domestic leagues, irrespective of how many people are watching Arsenal and Man United and the ICC and European football, competitive with the four major sports that are being gagged by the unwillingness to open up the league structure in this country. It is a separate issue, and it is an important issue. Look, I think maybe MP and Silva's $4 billion offer was a bit of a publicity stunt. We know Silva owns a second division team in Miami, and he very badly wants that team to be in the first division. We also know, by the way, Silva, he bought into a closed second division. I don't believe teams should be able to buy into closed second divisions and move up to the first division because they win a championship. I believe in open systems where you start in the fifth division, or you do what FC United and Manchester has done. You do what AFC Wimbledon has done. That's a true open system,
right?
And that will generate so much more interest and enthusiasm in the sport. MLS's TV ratings aren't going to get any better, are they, with this structure?
Right.
Do you think they will, Chris?
No, not at all.
No.
I still think that there is a connection between the two of these. So let me explain that, too. So from ICC, essentially this is becoming now a global soccer league, an annual tradition. And I can see that it is essentially that now, other than in name only, and it's a Champions Cup. But they could usually turn that around and say, okay, it's now an international Champions League, you know, rather than an actual cup. And to make it add a little bit more competitiveness to it, yes, some teams.
They actually keep a table, so it's a little bit of that already.
Right. Yeah, I think it's just positioning. But essentially what they have is a global summer league. And I think for the United States, I mean, to me, that's that's kind of a slam dunk. I mean, this is exactly what this market's wanting to see is Messi and all these stars from around the world playing competitive football. And we've got that. But the connection I see, though, Kartik, is the balance between the two. So with ICC as one example, but really what you have is ICC is a TV product at the end of the day. Yes, there's getting massive attendances, but I see that future as being more of a TV product as well as generating tons of money from tickets. And I see the balance being that in a typical week, say in the summertime, is you're trying to find that balance between, okay, you have enough money to go to watch a soccer game in person. So maybe you go see Juve against PSG, but then for the weekend, then you go and say, okay, you know what? I'm going to go watch my local soccer team. So whether it's Major League Soccer, NASL, USL, NPSL, I mean, you go down the list. There's so much there to choose from. But at this present moment in time, I think what's happening is that most soccer fans are watching soccer on television. And unless there's a MLS team right down the road from them nearby, they're deciding not to go to watch these games in person. They'd rather watch it on television, or if these teams come to the United States every summer, that they'll go and spend a lot of money, spend hundreds of dollars to go watch these teams in person. I think there is a way to balance the two, where you do have still the television aspect, where the league does the International Champions Cup and the Premier League, and you watch those games maybe in the morning times. Well, ICC, you know, but Premier League or La Liga or Serie A, you go down the long list. And then in the evenings on the weekends, then you take your family or your friends and you go to these games. The issue that we have today is that the way that MLS is structured and the way that the U.S. soccer pyramid is structured is there's a lot of people avoiding those. They don't want to go see an NASL game. They don't want to see an MLS game, because they see that leagues or those leagues as not having stars. They see those leagues as being not as competitive or not as good.
And but I think that's never going to change. Look, there are other countries. Australia has the same problem. You can talk to anyone who covers the A-League. They have the same exact problem.
But I think with the MP Silver deal, though, too, with that injection of money, if they decided to go down that path, that's the best route to go in terms of trying to bolster up, trying to strengthen these leagues, give these teams more funding so that they can go out there.
You are not going to get the biggest stars in this country. Well, I'm sorry. I know people say the NASL did back in the day, but that was pre-Bosman ruling. That was pre-free movement of labor within the EU. It's very easy to get an EU passport now, even if you're a South American or if you have Italian ancestry or something, and just move around leagues and clubs in Europe. I don't think it's going to happen.
So, what's the alternative, though? I mean, for Major League Soccer?
There is no alternative. The alternative is you're not going to have the top league in the world here. You're not going to have one of the top leagues in the world here. It's to accept what we have in the domestic game, the limitations. But the limitations are greater when you don't take a deal like the MP and Silva deal or some sort of deal to open up the pyramid. You can have a very strong, domestically based league system, which is relevant to everybody and every community, because you have an open league and any team can advance through that system. And then I think another problem is the USSF Development Academy. You've dealt with this personally, Chris. It's beginning to choke the life out of youth clubs that are excluded from that thing. That's a whole nother discussion, but that's part and parcel of the same thing. U.S. soccer has promoted a closed league structure. And I think promotion and relegation and open leagues is really I mean, this sounds maybe bombastic or draconian, depending on your perspective, but it's probably the only long-term solution to make the sport in this country as relevant as it should be. So the question is, I go back to, and I hate to bring this up, Ruud Gullit, when he was here in Los Angeles Galaxy, Chris, you probably remember this, mm-hmm. made the comment that he felt like after the experience, MLS was a NFL plot to keep soccer in a box in this country. And I thought it was ludicrous when he said it.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking back, but it's Ruud Gullit, so you have to take it seriously, right? Yeah. His stature demands that.
His resume, right.
Yeah, I think back and I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily an NFL plot, but it's a lot of NFL trained thinkers that might. I don't know if they're necessarily trying to keep soccer down, but there's something at play. There's some motivation for why they're not willing to open the system up.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it's all about greed, I think, because Don Garber answers to the owners or the investors in Major League Soccer. Most of them are rich NFL owners who are already incredibly wealthy, who own teams such as the New England Patriots, etc., people like Robert Kraft. And that's who he's answering to. So he's not answering to or focusing on the fans. He's just making sure
he's
protecting their interests.
The owners of MLS clubs that have come to the league more recently, the guys like the Merrick Paulsons in Portland, who I know has pushed the envelope on a couple of issues related to the salary cap, like the Seattle owners, like Flavio Da Silva here in Orlando, who is comes from a Brazilian background, obviously, and is and I think would be would like some sort of open system and some ability to compete compete for players, because Orlando has been in trouble previously. They've been reported twice to the league by opposing teams for poaching or interfering or trying to tap up players, which. They're not really tapping up players in an open system. It's not like tapping up in Europe where you make an illegal approach. What Orlando's done would be what would be legal in any other system, but they've gotten in trouble for it. So I think Garber, this is a risk with MLS expansion, because I think even though they're getting their $150 million a pop, you're bringing in owners who I think are probably more versed in the world game than those NFL owners, unless they award expansion teams to four NFL-oriented ownership groups, which I don't think is going to happen. San Antonio was they might, NFL, NBA-oriented groups. But if you bring in some owners that are kind of younger, more versed with the world game, more versed with their fans, there might be some change from within. I mean, keep an eye on Cincinnati if they get into the league. I think that they're very ambitious, and their ownership is great. Maybe they don't get into the league.
Well,
keep an eye on Tampa
Bay.
That's, same thing.
Well, that's the thing, though, too, Kartik. In that letter that Silva wrote to Don Garber, he mentioned in there, he started the letter off saying that I've been in contact and having some great frank discussions with the owners and several kind of decision makers in and around Major League Soccer. And essentially, here's what I'm proposing. So there's definitely some buy-in among some of the owners, probably the newer owners, while, say, the Robert Krafts of the world are still kind of stuck in the MLS 1.0 generation, where they're not willing to change, they're not willing to have any open
Let's
system.
Let's just think about this here. Malcolm Glazer lives here in the state of Florida. John Henry lives
he's
right
deceased.
Joel Glazer lives here in the state of Florida. Malcolm Glazer lived in the state of Florida when he bought Manchester United. John W. Henry, his office was in the same building as my wife's office in Boca Raton. You're talking about investors here in the United States that have chosen to spend their money on football abroad. It is the best product out there, but they're not willing to put any sort of money into the game domestically, because there's kind of an upward ceiling.
Well,
you
look at Stephen Ross, though. I mean, Stephen Ross is
another good example.
A billionaire. Yeah. I mean, multi-billionaire. And he was asked this week, and actually I don't have the quote in front of me, but he was asked this week, why aren't you investing in Major League Soccer? And he says, I have no need to. He says, I have all the best teams from Europe coming here over here every summer, playing in my stadium. And he's also planning on having ICC games throughout the year. So it wouldn't be just a summer thing. That he's probably looking for winter breaks or international breaks. And
he's also going to be bringing. He's also probably. I don't know if this has been out there or we're breaking news here, but my understanding is he's also probably going to bring Brazil here a couple times before the World Cup in 2018 to Miami.
Wow, but that's the thing too. I mean, to me, ICC is Major League Soccer's worst nightmare, because it really opens up. So for an average, so mainstream person, sports fan who goes to watch one of these games in person, sees the quality of play, sees the competitiveness, sees the world stars, that person is probably not going to go to Major League Soccer games unless it's kind of a fun family experience and it's a nice night out and it's affordable. That person,
right? So those people, two different sets of fans here, though. Those people are never going to go to MLS games. They don't go to A-League games. They don't go to Chinese Super League games. They don't go to games in the Indian League. But then there are local grassroots oriented soccer people who go to their kid, drive their kids to youth games like you do, Chris, that sometimes go to local fourth division games or NASL games, who have no interest in Major League Soccer because there's no way the team in their community, unless some gazillionaire comes and says, oh, you know what, I'm going to buy into the closed league structure of MLS. They actually engage in the domestic game in this country, and they are preferring to watch the Premier League or La Liga on television, not just because it's a higher level of sport to them, because it's obviously going to be that, but it's also because it has more personal connection to them. MLS has no relevance outside its markets, and I think you said that at the beginning of this argument, at the beginning of this discussion, excuse me, and that is really the big takeaway. It has no relevance. The television ratings show us that. You know what? Honestly, in a lot of its markets, it has no relevance in its market. You see that from local television ratings where teams like Salt Lake, Orlando, they do well when their teams are playing away from home on the over-the-air channels or the local cable channels that they that they're on. But teams like the LA Galaxy, no one watches that team in Los Angeles. No one cares about that team except for the 30,000, 40,000 diehards, most of whom go each week to the Home Depot Center.
Yeah.
Same thing with the New York team. Same thing with the Philly team. The teams in big markets, no one cares about.
Yeah, and that's why I think the MLS has to change, because I mean, you can watch your...
Yeah, I have to tell you, in some of these big markets, there are very sustainable lower division teams and people who are not going to MLS games because they're like, well, I like the Ventura County Fusion and they're a fourth division team and they can never be first division. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. There's lots of those. Detroit, Minneapolis. Look, Minnesota is a new MLS market. That team moved up from NASL. There is a real underground movement. It's not so underground anymore for Minneapolis City FC, which is a fourth division team. And people have bought into memberships to that team. There's a team in San Francisco in an MLS market, San Jose Earthquakes, that has done the same and is getting like 2,000 fans a game. These people are buying in and spending their money on the domestic game, and they have no interest in Major League Soccer because it's a closed league.
And that's the thing about the MP and Silva deal, too, is that if anyone needed any clarification clarification essentially on where MLS is at and what they're thinking, this was it in terms of them coming back and saying, like, no, we're not interested. And yes, there's contractual reasons why they can't talk about it now. They have to wait until the next cycle. But I think it's pretty emphatic, though, too, from MLS's point of view, is that they're not interested in any type of deal where they start to lose control and start to change their vision of what they see as U.S. soccer. I mean, that's their vision. And I think at the end of the day, I think there is a way to balance things as far as having your best teams from around the world watching them on television in the mornings or Friday nights or whatever, and then going Saturday night to watch your local team. And that's the thing from this past week, Kartik. I've seen just a huge groundswell of just the lower leagues, like fans from around the country that are not in MLS cities that support their local teams, that were responding very negatively to the MP and Silva deal in terms of MLS saying no to this. And I think that they're feeling left out too. Here's a huge opportunity, not just for Major League Soccer, but for the lower leagues in the U.S. And I think we all know at this point where MLS stands.
So maybe I come from a biased perspective. Maybe I come from a perspective of having worked in those lower leagues now for a number of years, alongside my media work. I think that the numbers of those people are far greater than MLS thinks they are. And you know what? I think maybe to a certain extent they've acknowledged it, because they used to just have these random expansion teams, right? Whoever paid their expansion fee. Now it seems like just about every team they bring into the league is being brought up, with the exception of Atlanta recently and Philly, is being brought up from the lower divisions. They realize there's this groundswell of support that is taking place outside their league, and their only play, because they're a closed league, to try and appeal to fans in those markets to say, hey, you know, if you support your team and you're so supportive that you can attract an investor who has billions, you too could be part of our private little club. That's really their only appeal to these people.
Which is what Don Garber said several years ago to the Strikers fans that were...
Yeah, I was in the room when he said that to us.
I was there too. I was there too. So he said basically what you need to do is just increase the attendance, and then there's no reason why MLS couldn't come into this market in South Florida.
Right, and we're all looking at each other, and there are, of course, a whole contingent of people saying, oh, yeah, let's do that because we want to be in MLS. I would love for the Strikers to have been in MLS also, but there was no – that had no relevance to the actual Strikers product. And it was basically get your attendance up, find an investor who's willing to drop hundreds of millions of dollars in our kind of closed league, and you too can be one of us. There's no sporting merit attached to it, which gets back to the larger picture, which is it's not relevant to people outside of MLS cities. And I think the disconcerting thing, and Chris, to tie a bow on this whole thing, is anytime Pro Rel comes up, anytime Open Leagues come up, even from people like me who I think are moderate and nuanced in our position, because I say, okay, it can't happen overnight. We need to bring the lower leagues up to a certain level. And MLS has done a lot of great things for soccer in this country and continues to with their investment in development academies. That would be the real takeaway now that I would say they're doing well. I'm not one of those extremists who say, oh, MLS should die, MLS should be it should go away, and they've never done anything and we've lost 30 years in this country in soccer. I'm not one of those people, but we're at a point where the league has to open up, or we have to have an open structure, or there will be a structure. I think I mentioned this on a previous show. There will be a structure that emerges outside of Major League Soccer. As much as they've choked the investment in the game, there potentially will be something that emerges down the road, unless U.S. soccer very openly blocks it, which is tough, difficult for them to do, because then they face the possibility of antitrust lawsuits, et cetera. That emerges, but that would emerge over a long period of time. It would be much easier if we had we have an established first division. They've done a great job of doing that. That's ready to open up and make this system something that is inclusive to everyone in this country, and also allows them in some respect to compete with these leagues abroad. I don't think they're ever going to be able to compete for players at the highest level with European clubs. But I do think that you can compete for the entertainment dollars and for the investment dollars of people who are already in soccer in this country. Look, there are people who are, for lack of a better term, are Euro snobs. And you have them in Australia, you have them in China, like I've mentioned before, that just watch European football. They have no interest in local soccer. They're not involved in youth soccer locally. They don't watch. They might have a third or fourth division team in their town. It wouldn't be a third division team this season, but they might have a lower division team in their town, and they're not even aware they exist. Those people MLS is never going to win over. So forget it. They're going to ICC games. That's great. They watch Arsenal. That's fine. The A-League has the same problem. The J-League in Japan has the same problem, etc. But there are people who are engaged in the sport. And Chris, I have to ask you this in closing. Do you think the backlash caught MLS off guard this week, or do you think they just don't care? Because they I think if they were in tune to social media, they would have seen how many people there are that support lower division clubs in this country that are furious about this.
I think both. I think they don't care, and I think they were surprised. So I think it's one of those things that they don't care, as in they have their model. The name of the game for Major League Soccer is expansion. I mean, getting those expansion fees, and that's their focus, as well as other things. But that's the main focus, as well as putting more money in the pockets of their investors. I think they were surprised by it, and I'm sure they're hoping that this whole thing dies down and that everyone can move on to the next topic. But to me, I think it does prove a point. I think it's ICC plus MP and Silver that the TV deal offer is that MLS has to change in order to still be relevant. I mean, because it's one of those things that on television, it's not working. In person, they're doing well in those cities. But like you said, it's going to reach a point where expansion will be over. And now they have to figure out, okay, what's next? Because without those expansion fees, that's when the rubber meets the road. And that's going to be an incredibly difficult time for them. And they're at risk of being left behind. And I think from this past week with the MP and Silver deal, especially so, there's been a groundswell. I've just been amazed by how many people at a local level throughout the United States have been responding to this in a really negative fashion towards MLS and looking at MLS as an outsider, as someone that's stuck in the Stone Ages. And I think really that MLS has to start thinking about changing. What they may end up doing at the end of the day down the road is reaching a compromise where it is a closed system, but it's with some type of relegation promotion that they can control, whether it's an application process or something where they can guarantee investors that their money, but then give some semblance of promotion relegation, try to keep the soccer fans happy, and it's going to be one of those things that's probably not going to work out that well, because it's, I mean, we can see through that. But yeah, it's fascinating times, Kartik, and I think at the end of the day, MLS has a ton of challenges ahead of them, from the television side especially, and from this MP and Silver deal. That was really a PR masterpiece from them, especially the timing of it, with the International Champions Cup coming up and being played this week, putting that on the radar and seeing what the reaction was. And the two things came together at just the right time for them. Yes, I think MLS was surprised, but I think they don't care. All right, Kartik, so where can listeners find you on the internet if they want to chat with you or find out what's your latest stories around the internet?
Yeah, Twitter, KKFLA737. You can find me at World Soccer Talk, thefloridasqueeze.com, prostamerica.com, bunch of different yanksarecoming.com, a bunch of different websites around the net.
So if you like the show, share it with your friends on social media, and be sure to post a review on iTunes. We appreciate it greatly. Thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.